So it's been unseasonably warm here in Cincinnati, and I would normally be thrilled about that, but it's been early March here in Cincinnati, and it's not supposed to be warm. It's what we call unseasonably warm, which is another way of saying global warming is real. You know, let's just face it. There are some advantages. There are some disadvantages. You're going to have to live with the disadvantages. So, I don't know. I went for a bike ride a couple of days ago. It was beautiful. And another thing that is beautiful is the opportunity to think about thoughts and think about ideas and think about experiences that make our lives better. And when I do that, often it is with my friend John Wright, who is with me today.
Hey, Bart.
Hey, John.
Do you do that when you're bike riding? Do you like to think a lot when you're riding?
You know, I do. It's not considered proper to wear earphones when you're bike riding.
Mm.
It's dangerous and irresponsible, and I only do it occasionally when I'm on a bike trail and there's no traffic around. But in general, I'm out there silently riding, and it sounds terrible, but I'm thinking about like what gear am I in and why do my legs hurt so much? And gee, I got to get around that pothole. But a lot of times if I stop at the beginning of a ride and think, let's use this ride to think about this person or this thing or this experience, I can have a really good time doing that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm very much like that too, where if I'm doing something automatic, like that feels sort of like at some lower level of brain function to keep doing it. Like when I'm on the phone, I'm pacing around my house, or like I'm going on a walk literally to talk to someone. Where you and I have done that in LA. We would go on a walk and go get coffee or something, and then like we'd be talking the whole way. And I think that helps me think in some strange way.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're a verbal processor.
Yeah, probably.
And that's a good
thing.
So. Yeah. And that's why it's hard for me. I'm a verbal processor. And so sometimes I don't think very effectively or well when I'm riding or when I'm walking. I do better if I'm writing. At least I'm putting my thoughts into specific words.
Mm. And thinking about those words as you do it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. You know, I think I was talking to somebody about Bruce Willis, the actor.
So sad what he's going through.
Yeah. He has aphasia, which I think is understood as the inability to recognize words anymore. He's losing his ability to kind of grasp language. And I was saying like, well, does that just mean that he can't understand what other people are saying, or that he can't speak, but he can understand what's being said? And as far as I understand it, like it's hard for him to understand the sounds and the
How alienating too, right? Like it's got to be just the most frustrating experience.
Yeah, yeah. You sort of think about the relationship between language and thought. That's the weird thing is that, you know, without words, can we think? And certainly the kinds of words that we have available to us shape our thoughts.
100%. That is a very... Did you ever see that movie Arrival that it kind of explored that a little bit?
Oh, the one where the aliens are behind the glass wall?
Yeah, and it's essentially a movie about linguistics.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, having just gotten off the phone with Sasha Sagan recently, and
she's so great.
Her father wrote Contact.
Right.
Which
one of my favorite films.
It's the only novel he wrote, but yeah, it was turned into a film with Matthew McConaughey and Jodie Foster.
Yeah, I read Contact, watched the movie first, and then read the book.
Yeah. So anyway, but that idea of, yeah, if something doesn't communicate in words, can it think the way we think? I'm stammering, but...
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of words, I have a question for you this time that... I think is interesting. And this is going to be, I think, just a fun little thought exercise or conversation around this guy's question that I actually think I've thought about a fair amount myself. And I'm curious if you have too. Do you consider yourself to be ready for the question?
I am. And sometimes, truth be told, sometimes I know the question you're going to ask before you ask it. But in this case, I have no idea what is on your mind.
All right. Okay. Dear Bart, I'm going to bisect this, I think it might be the word, into two parts, but I'm just going to ask you the first part. Dear Bart, I have a question for you that came out of a conversation with my Christian friend over drinks on Saturday night. Like you, I don't believe in God or heaven or hell. But since none of us know for sure, my friend asked me, if I had to bet on it, how sure am I? Here's how he asked the question. How surprised would you be to someday find yourself in any kind of conscious afterlife when you die? Assuming you think the evangelical version of heaven and hell is close to 0% likelihood to exist, what likelihood of any kind of post-life experience?
Wow. I think
you're smiling.
I can, yes, I am. I can confidently say that I would be colossally surprised to wake up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, let's start with the evangelical version. Like, you would be colossally surprised, I'm sure, to find yourself like at the pearly gates, so to speak, or any kind of equivalent.
It's unimaginable to me that that could happen.
I always remember this question that our mutual friend William Crawley asked Richard Dawkins in an interview. He said, what if he died and went to the pearly gates and God said, why didn't you believe in me? Bertrand Russell, who said, not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence. But Dawkins said, in any case, what's so special about belief? What's so important about belief?
But certainly if God confronted me at the pearly gates and said, why didn't you believe in me? I would be unable to answer because I would just be so gobsmacked that I was there in the first place. I would go like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Yeah. You'd be that surprised.
Oh my gosh.
Because right now it just seems so implausible to you.
Well, even if there is some kind of supernatural force that everybody's trying to wrap their head around or describe, you know, there are literally thousands of gods and permutations and possibilities. Like, what are the chances that the particular permutation of God that, like, I was exposed to as a 15-year-old kid is the one?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, not Muhammad.
Yeah.
You know, not Muhammad's vision of God, not the Buddha's vision of the world, you know, not, you know, Hinduism, not Shiva. No, it turns out it's Jesus and his male father God. You know, like, that would just be so, the odds of that are so vanishingly small.
And also there's something about heaven and the whole idea of it that you have more plausible explanations for how people came to believe that, that strike you as much more likely to be the real reason that people believe it.
Yeah, that's what I always say. It totally makes sense to me that somebody believes in heaven.
Yeah.
The idea that heaven might actually exist makes no sense whatsoever to me. Like, there's no evidence for that.
Yeah.
So I would be gobsmacked.
Okay.
I just, you know. And
you
think
would probably
honestly
have like a million more questions. Like, well, okay, so what? How? What is the mechanism? Yeah, like you have so many more things that you need to know.
Yeah, and I would just be so filled with remorse. Like I was riding the right train by accident and I got off. And I got off? Like, you know, yeah, no, that would be great. Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is
that piece, by the way, you saying that you'd be so full of remorse is all that evangelicals need to hear you say.
Yeah, just cut that one right out.
Cut that one out.
If I met God at the pearly gates, I would be so full of remorse.
Yeah, there you go. You've given them the perfect soundbite.
But, you know, the other thing is that just the idea that I would wake up conscious and that I would have a self-consciousness of myself as Bart, sans brain. Like, yeah, I have no brain.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no place to store any of those memories, but like somehow they've just
they've transposed onto whatever substrate you're in now.
Now listen, and don't let my son hear this. He will be horrified by this. You know, he will think it is the most arrogant thing anyone could ever say to like write it all off. But even if I'm willing to, you know, the question is like, will my energy find a new manifestation? Like, does life itself go on, or is life itself embedded in the idea of life so that even if you take away the reality, it would reconstitute itself some other way, the same way it constituted itself the first time? Like, I can believe all of that. Like, if you want me to believe in eternal life or sporadical eternal life, like life springing up and going out, like I believe any of that stuff. You tell me that this particular collection of thoughts and ideas and physicality somehow outlives this particular body, I go like, wow, you got me. I didn't see it coming.
Right. And sometimes I hear people say that, like, because we know from physics that energy goes on in some form.
It's
right?
conserved, yes.
Yeah. And like, you will become something else. They then extrapolate that into spiritual terms. And like, they use it in a very, sometimes in a very like abstract, new agey way. So we're beyond evangelicalism now. Like, we're into just like any kind, what this person asked, what likelihood of any kind of post-life experience?
I mean, the atoms that make up my body almost certainly were somebody's poop, were, you know, like was
something,
the core of some star somewhere. Like, there's no doubt that everything that is in me will be recycled.
Mm-hmm. But that's very different from consciousness continuing.
I tend to think of me as the pattern, like the setup, this particular arrangement
of molecules.
Things. Yes. And not even the molecules, because the molecules evidently, like, you know, as you eat food, they replace each other. Your skin cells fall off. You get new skin cells, even though you still have the same scars. All I'm saying is, like, when I think of myself, like, I'm this particular arrangement and
of stuff.
Yeah. Like this floor plan. And so, like, even the idea that you would burn this house down and then you would build another house using the same floor plan. I'm like, but where are you going to get the floor plan? You know, like, who's mapped me out?
I get what you're saying. So because you are nature and nurture, right? Neither of which you've chosen,
yeah,
or played any part in. I mean, you played a small part in maybe your nurture just by being you, but that's nature. And so you've become this thing called Bart, and it's unique life experiences, unique to you, a history over 50 some odd years. And so you're saying the idea that that arrangement of stuff would ever exist in any other form other than the one that's here now and that will die just doesn't make any sense to you.
You know, it's funny. It's like, even my psychedelic trips.
Well, this is what this person actually asked. I'll just, since we're already there, let me repeat the rest of this email.
Okay.
So he says, what about panpsychism, the idea that our consciousness isn't created by our brain, but it's a fundamental of the universe and we're merely tapping into it? What about the possibility that we're all in a simulation and therefore death isn't what it seems? And finally, have any of your experiences with psychedelics changed how you feel about the likelihood of an afterlife of some kind?
Oh, that I'll start with the third one, because like I was just going to say, like, absolutely. My psychedelic trips.
How many have you had at this point?
Gosh, like probably five.
Okay.
DMT, LSD. I'm trying to think if I've done anything other
than psilocybin mushrooms?
No, because I'm allergic to mushrooms and so I'm afraid of taking them.
Oh, right. Yeah. I remember that story. Yeah.
The way in which I've sort of gotten lost in the back warehouse of my stored memories and images and things, I didn't even know I was remembering, like, really, really arcane stuff, experiences that came up. I came out of that and I thought, like, it's like I opened one file drawer in the Library of Congress. And I was overwhelmed by all the stuff I found in there. I could have spent a whole lifetime just looking at that one file drawer.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
I'm aware that, like, that was just like such a random thing. And so yeah, when I came back from those trips and realized just the sheer volume of oddly arranged thoughts, ideas, images that are in there, I just thought, the absurdity of somebody going like, well, you know what? We've got a new technology where we can map your brain synapse for synapse. I'm like, dude, if you can do that, literally, no more power to you because you're already omnipotent. You know, it's just so beyond my imagination. And like, that's the biggest mistake that we make. The biggest mistake that we make as humans is to think that the limits of our imagination, the limits of our experience are the limits of imagination, are the limits of experience.
Right,
right. To think that the world as we see it or as we understand it, is those are the limits. The limits that we can imagine are the limits. So I'm no doubt wrong about all of this. The question was not, you know, do you think, like, do you want to sign off 100% correct? The question was, how surprised would you be?
Exactly.
And the answer is,
exactly,
immeasurably. Like, it's inconceivable to me. And my psychedelic trips have made it more inconceivable, not less.
So Nick Bostrom was the guy that came up with this simulation argument in the first. I actually interviewed him years ago from Oxford University, and his whole thing was that at some point, if you extrapolate current development of computing power into the future long enough, you eventually will get to a point where computers are capable of simulating every one of the synapses you're talking about and all of the complexity of those files and files of memories and mind, the full contents of mind, millions of times over, to where all of us could be part of that simulation.
You know, the argument that I've heard is it's actually more likely that we are in a simulation than that we're not.
Yeah, that was his conclusion, is that essentially it comes down to numbers eventually. You just go like, what's the likelihood that we're the first run population, the few, rather than the many hypothetically simulated? So given a couple of assumptions, it becomes more likely that we're simulated than not.
Was Nick really buying that, do you think? Like when you're talking to him, it's like I think he really thinks this is true.
Yeah, I asked him. I can't remember his exact answer, but he did have a percentage chance that he thought that it was true. Maybe it was like, you know, 20 or 30%, but it wasn't close to zero. Like he really did think there was a possibility that it was true.
You know, the other thing, John, is like, you know, worldview humility to me. Yeah. One of the things that it says is like, whatever it is that you think, of course you think you're right. If you didn't think you were right, you would change your mind and think something else. But what it says is like, you at least ought to be humble enough to recognize that you don't think what you think because it is right or because it is evidence-based, even if it is evidence-based, that you think it's right because you were socialized to think it was right.
Yeah.
Or your experiences led you to believe it was right. And so that's the place where, like, you know, part of the reason I think that all this eternal life and, you know, God stuff is absurd is because I had this experience of like, being in it, seeing how the sausage was made, like thinking my way out of it, like being angry at it for taking away a lot of my life privileges and a lot of my life's time. And so you go like, well, that's the reason you can't conceive of being true, is because like you psychologically can't handle the fact that like you were wrong again.
Right.
You
know?
And
right.
Like that could be totally true. Like I'm worldview humble enough
right.
to recognize.
You were even very tolerant of my question to you in the film I made about you and your dad, that it was maybe a psychological need to get away from your dad and be in your own world. You know, you were very tolerant of all every possibility of how you landed where you landed.
Absolutely. I'm just saying from whatever terrible trauma and psychological mistreatment and foolishness landed me in this place, from the place that I stand, there are few ideas that seem less plausible to me than the idea that my identity will outlive my earthly body.
Yeah. Do you remember Danny Kahneman, the psychologist that wrote that book? He came up with a lot of ideas. One of the things was
thinking fast and small. Kahneman and
thinking fast and slow. Thinking fast and slow. Yeah. And he talked about the experiencing self and the remembering self and how they're actually quite different. You know, you think about that, like how your memories are stored in a physical location, like they're actual molecules in your brain, like neurons that whose job it is to remember, you know? And if you cut out that part of your brain, you're not going to remember that thing anymore. That's, first of all, that's kind of wild, but that's how we work. We know that now. So yeah, even if somehow consciousness is something else or bigger, or like our brain is more like, as has been suggested by some people, our brain is more like a radio transmitter tuning into consciousness or something like that. How is that remembering self going to transcend it? It just doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, at the very least, like have you ever been in like a stereo store and you're trying out different speakers and so they're playing the same CD or the same radio station, but they're
on different
the tuner
speakers.
Is switching to different speakers.
Yes.
And so you get to see like, ooh, this one has a big bass, or that one's rich fidelity, or this is really cheap tinny one, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, even if I believe that consciousness is this one thing and that we are just all like receivers and channels and all that stuff, and I don't mean to sound airy-fairy when I say that we're all receivers.
None channels. Of which we have any evidence for.
Right. But even if that were true, I go like, the music coming out of me would be shaped by the hardware, by my hardware.
That's a good analogy. Yeah.
And so I think like you say, well, if I wipe you away, Bart, there'll be another speaker. It'll be in tune with the same consciousness. And I go like, oh yeah, that's, yeah, I believe that. That could be true. Well, then on some level, you'll still be part of the consciousness. I go, no, no, no. Like, I'm the speaker. When you get rid of my specificity, it'll never sound the same as it sounds when it's being pumped through those speakers. By the way, I'm realizing like I'm channeling my psychedelic trip, because on my psychedelic trip, when I had ego death, one of the things that sort of like I found myself embodying or being was a 1970s plastic stereo speaker.
Oh, wow.
It's just weird. Like that's maybe that's where that
Michael Pollan
from.
Had a similar experience where he was becoming the music or something like that. He was in a very like sort of manufactured world, metallic elements and plastic elements and things like that. Yeah.
What's funny is I can remember exactly where I was physically when I had that, when that happened. I was going down the Pacific Coast Highway. Mm-hmm. Roman was driving the car. I was not driving. Roman was both sober and driving, and he was, and it was nighttime, and he was playing this weird ethereal Pink Floyd music.
Oh, very deliberately, I'm sure.
And I just like, all of a sudden, like I wasn't there anymore. I was the speaker and the music was flowing through me, and it was
so
very
so to go
wacky.
Back to this listener's question, does an experience like that make you more likely or less likely to sort of think that there may be something about you that's different than you thought it was? I mean, because that's a very different, you know, they sort of talk about altered states of consciousness. I mean, if you've never experienced an altered state, a drastically altered state of consciousness, then maybe you don't think that such things are even possible.
Okay, so I'm going to take your question, like things about me that are radically different than I expect. And I go like, yes, there are things about me were completely unexpected. Like there are vast seas of possibility in my consciousness that can be altered by drugs, that could be altered by experiences, can be altered by time and all that stuff. Like, so like, yes, there's an infinite amount of stuff, but me, like the me that has an infinite, untold, unexplored territory to it, that me is sitting on a chair in Cincinnati right now in my body and brain. And like, when you wipe out this body and brain, that me that has all those untold possibilities that will never be explored is gone. So my experience let me think that there's infinitely more to me than I thought there was.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't make you question the limitations of the me that experienced it.
No, on the contrary, because the reason I was seeing those limitless possibilities was because of chemicals coursing through my brain.
Yes.
Like it was a physical thing that was causing this stuff to happen.
Yeah, but you know that a lot of people who have those experiences suddenly believe in things they didn't believe in before.
Yeah, and bless their hearts. And what I would say is that, you know, I mean, I remember reading the book Alive, which was about this Uruguayan rugby team that crashed in the Andes Mountains. And they ended up surviving only by eating the dead bodies of the ones that had died before them. And it was a very strange and beautiful book about love and community.
Mm-hmm.
But what they found was is that the people that survived, I think it was like 18 or 20 of them that survived, were incredibly close. They had been together for months and they had gone through unimaginable hardship. And they had been saved by, you know, like the heroic efforts of a few of them. And when they emerged from it, what they found was is that some of the survivors had been believers, staunch Catholics before they went. And when the experience was over, they had lost all faith. They couldn't believe in God anymore. And others of them had been strict secular atheists when they left. And by the time they got down, they were convinced that God was real. And so the same experience had carried them both ways across the faith divide.
Yeah.
And I just think like, and perhaps whatever worldview you had going into a situation that hard, it would invalidate that worldview. You'd go like, there's got to be more than what I thought it was. So the secular people were like, there's got to be God. And the God mm-hmm. people were like, you know what, the God thing is not, that hypothesis doesn't explain this. So it's got to be more than God. It's got to be like the universal here and now materials thing. So all I'm saying is that the way we see things is so conditioned by our previous experience that the idea that a particular experience will change people in a particular way, that's the thing I've come to be more suspicious of. I go like, you're like, well, this will change you. And I go, yeah, it'll change you. like how will it change you? Depends on who you were when you walked in the door.
Right, right.
Which is, you know, maybe a way to sign off the podcast and sort of go like, whoever you are, whatever you brought to this podcast probably is what's going to determine what you take away from this podcast. And if you like this podcast, it says more about you than it does about this podcast. And if you hated this podcast, it says more about you than it says about this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's good. I hope you liked it.
Yeah. No, very interesting. And so you don't have a percentage answer for this listener, but you do have a kind of like...
It's vanishingly small.
Yeah.
It's vanishingly small. It's so funny because like, I guess if you believe in past lives and future lives and reincarnation, maybe like the idea that like me ultimately falling in love with Rock Hudson and us getting married and living together in another universe, like maybe that doesn't seem implausible to you, but like from, you know, in this material world that we live in, like that's actually fully impossible.
Right.
But like, then again, you never, you know, they may find ways to reanimate rocks, you know? Like,
yeah.
So like Nick Bostrom might say, there's a chance of me and Rock getting together.
There's at least a chance. There's at least
a
chance.
And I go like, I would say that the chances of me waking up in heaven or hell are roughly the chances of me waking up married to Rock Hudson.
Yeah. Well, I think you at one point used that thing about Justin Bieber, you know, an email coming through from Justin Bieber that says, hey, I've got a few million dollars in a bank account in Switzerland waiting for you. You just need to do this and this, you know. What are the chances of it being true?
And I go like, that is actually possible.
It is
he
possible.
He has that kind of money. There are Swiss bank accounts. And I'm like, and you go like, but do I, like, so I'm agnostic about that. I'm agnostic. I admit that I don't know if Justin has done that. What I do know is that I don't make a single decision in my life based on that possibility, because that's how vanishingly small it seems to me.
Yes.
So for all intents and purposes, I am an atheist. Mm-hmm. Even though I am not an atheist.
By that definition. So, okay, how about you just listen to, I'll go where you won't go, okay? I'm going to say heaven and hell and the evangelical Jesus, the lowest possibility. I assign the lowest possibility. Just because been there, know the story, I know too much about, you know, Bart Ehrman would say, you know, told me a bit more about where it came from. You know, panpsychism. Panentheism, some formula, look up those terms on your own time, like maybe a bit more likely, still, in my opinion, pretty unlikely, you know? I think there's a bit more maybe to that idea based on some things, you know, the conversations
tarot
out there
cards?
About...
So
there we go, like tarot, we had a chaos witch on the show who did your tarot. What do you think the likelihood is that she's right?
Yeah, like all of these likelihoods are to the left of the, you know, the decimal where it's like 0.0, like the number of zeros before you get to that one are so many, so many.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
We're so far out there.
That's good. Okay.
You know, a breathless Christian will say to me like, you know, like, deep down, you must hold open the possibility
of something
that we're right.
I will say this. I know enough to know, or I feel like I've experienced enough to know, that whatever a surprising answer would be, you know, like let's say I was surprised upon my death in some way, or I was surprised by some experience that I just never saw coming. Whatever that reality is that I don't know about, be it a multiverse or a simulated, you know, outer reality. I don't know if you ever saw like is it Men in Black at the end? Like it zooms out from the Earth into the universe. And it turns out it's like a marble in a marble bag. The whole universe is, you know, and there's like, it would have to be that surprising. I think it would have to be that insanely unexpected, or whatever the answer is. If there's some bigger answer that we don't know about, it would have to be so insanely beyond our comprehension and our ability to even reason about it.
Yeah, it wouldn't be on
no
the
one's
menu
written
of,
a book. But, do you know what I mean? No one's written.
It wouldn't
a book.
Be on the menu of the list of things that we've already come up with.
Exactly, like, exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
I mean, we were wrong about 99 of them, but we did guess that one right.
Right. No, I don't think there's any guessing it. If there's anything at all beyond, then I don't think there's any guessing it. And by the way, I do hold out the idea that like we don't know where the universe came from. So there may be some surprising or unintuitive, out of our comprehension kind of reality that we, you know, but it's probably not anything that we've ever thought about. And I don't think that it's accessible or something that we ever will know about. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I would have just settled for a good second Matrix movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a shame.
All right.
Well, thank you, Bart. Hey, thanks for going there.
And whoever asked that question, thank you. And whoever listened to this podcast, thank you. And we're full of gratitude, full of joy, and looking forward to some really good conversations coming up down the road. On, guess what? I'm going to say it again. Humanize Me.
This podcast is made possible by supporters of the show on Patreon. Get an exclusive extra episode every month for less than the cost of a cup of coffee at patreon.com/humanizeme. You'll also get a video newsletter from Bart and some extra goodies. Our patrons make this show happen, so please, if you enjoy it, consider joining us. That's patreon.com/humanizeme. Bart's website, where you can contact him, is bartcampolo.org. And this episode is produced by Katie Johnson-Smith, me, John Wright, and Bart Campolo. Hey, you could be larger than life. You could.